In iFaith 103, I'll be preaching from a book I've never preached from before, and that's the prophet Nahum. Yes, I've taught classes on the minor prophets, and I'm familiar with some of the hot verses in Nahum, but I've never done a sermon on this. And what is a sermon on? This is so different from Jonah, which we looked at in the previous iFaith message. Jonah is commissioned to bring a warning to the Assyrians, by which they're able to save themselves. They respond well. There's grace. In the book of Nahum, there's no offer of forgiveness at all. It's 100% judgment. So different. Jonah is prose. It's a narrative, apart from the prayer inside the animal. but the rest of it is straight narrative. Nahum is poetry. Pretty much the entire thing. They're very different. Even though they focus on the same city, Nineveh, whose ruins are about a couple hundred miles north of Baghdad today, if it were safe, you could visit it by the Tigris River. Nineveh, the capital of Assyria. But Nineveh is very different in the 700s when Jonah is active than in the late 600s when Nahum delivers his message. The Syrians responded well to Jonah's message, but this is many generations later. They seem to worship power, raw and ruthless. Their soldiers are reputed to enjoy cruelty. I remember my Old Testament class when I was at Duke University was the first time I heard a professor refer to the Assyrians as the Nazis of the Old Testament. Well, I don't know if the Nazis were kinder than the Assyrians. It seems they might have been. The Assyrians were intense guys. And they had been oppressing Judah. Yes, they took the northern kingdom into captivity in 722 and destroyed the capital of Samaria. But the southern kingdom of Judah, even though it survived until the early 6th century, was almost entirely deprived of its autonomy. Yes, it still had a king and it still had the temple, but the kingdom itself was minuscule. So, I'll be reading selected verses from Nahum, which is just three chapters, so let's dig in. And, oh, the title of the message is The God of Wrath. I could talk about the wrath of God, but that sounds more like a class. Let's focus on one aspect of God. But the God of Wrath is a bit more shocking, and that's probably more in line with the feeling we get when we read books like Nahum. The Lord is a jealous and avenging God. The Lord takes vengeance and is filled with wrath. The Lord takes vengeance on his foes and vents his wrath against his enemies. The Lord is slow to anger, but great in power. The Lord will not leave the guilty unpunished. His way is in the whirlwind and the storm. The mountains quake before him and the hills melt away. The earth trembles at his presence. The world and all who live in it, who can withstand his indignation? Who can endure his fierce anger? His wrath is poured out like fire. The rocks are shattered before him. These are just some verses from chapter 1. And yes, we are able quickly to identify God's negative emotions. And when I say negative, I don't mean wrong or excessive or sinful, certainly. But negative in that I think you know what I mean. His anger. His jealousy. He's intolerant of rivals. God alone will be worshipped. He's angry. And actually, Nineveh here seems to be, Jonah here. No, I'm doubly sorry. Nahum here seems to be harking back to Exodus 34, where God reveals his nature, his name. And part of God's name is that he's slow to anger. So catch this. Yes, it's the wrath, it's fierce anger, and there's jealousy and there's vengeance, all in that little passage I read, but the Lord is slow to anger. In other words, it's just not impulsive. It's not a hair trigger response. It's not, God can't control his emotions somehow. God is very slow to anger. So his wrath, his anger, is based not on whim or just some feeling. It's based on his holy character. And that's really important. I so often hear people these days talking about God's negative emotions and almost in an embarrassed way, or wishing this wasn't in the Bible. I heard a preacher the other day talk about this, and the response, I don't know, the preacher's response, and this was to a different one of the minor prophets, would actually make the audience think that, well, maybe the preacher doesn't believe in the Bible. I think people have backed away so much because of the so-called God of the Old Testament. We've become so weak and wimpy. We've lost our salt. We've lost it. My friend Paul Copan, who's taught a lot, written a lot on this particular topic, has a book coming out fairly soon on the vindictive bully. Again, that's the impression people have of God, that he pushes people around. But no, he's slow to anger. In this message, I want us to grasp something of the seriousness, the sternness of God, but also his grace. So there are two sides, you could say, to God. Of course, it's one God. Just a few more verses from chapter 1. The Lord is good, a refuge in times of trouble. He cares for those who trust in him. But with an overwhelming flood, he will make an end of Nineveh. He will pursue his foes into the realm of darkness. Although I have afflicted you, Judah, I will afflict you no more. So here we see the justly deserved punishment coming to the Assyrians, but finally there will potentially be relief for Judah, for God's people. Continuing, the Lord has given a command concerning you, Nineveh. You will have no descendants to bear your name. I will destroy the images and idols that are the temple of your gods. I will prepare your grave, for you are vile. Look, there on the mountains, the feet of the one who brings good news, who proclaims peace. Celebrate your festivals, Judah, and fulfill your vows. No more will the wicked invade you. They will be completely destroyed. So can you feel the two sides here? So the Lord's good. He's a refuge. He's going to rescue his people. He'll bring the affliction to an end. Of course, we understand God himself is the one who authorized, who permitted Assyria to oppress his people. And they deserved it. It was a kind of discipline. And we read about good news. We read about peace and celebration. But in these same verses, he says, I've commanded about you, Nineveh, I'm going to destroy you. I'm going to destroy your images. And these words particularly, I will prepare your grave, for you are vile. You're disgusting. You're an affront to dignity. So we have the two aspects together. And if you try to, it's like pulling a thread. Let's take one thread out of my sweater or my fleece. If you're not careful, you'll end up pulling a lot more than just one thread. You can't remove the thread of God's wrath from his character and end up with God. They're very closely bound together. These are not vengeful emotions, not here in Nahum. They're natural. Actually, they're positive. So I thought, you know, I live in Europe. What was it like here when people celebrated the end of World War II? Finally, the Nazi Third Reich has been destroyed. Of course, there was a lot to grieve. But in September 1945, church bells are ringing. People are celebrating, weeping, embracing. And it's not because they hate the enemy. I'm sure many did. But no, this is something different. It's rejoicing because God's righteousness has been shown somehow. The evil one has been brought down. Or think of Europe in November 1918. Same thing with the end of World War I. I mean, how would Yahweh deal with Assyria? Well, God works through people and through nations in the Old Testament often. So God would work through warfare. And Assyria is a conqueror, and that conqueror will be conquered. Now, here's a warning in the words of one theologian. Nahum is a sturdy theology, not for the weak and squeamish. We may all affirm heartily God's role as liberator, but we are hesitant also to affirm liberation involves judgment. And that judgment in turn reveals the anger of a righteous God against the ruthlessness of human beings who think they can act with impunity. That is, powers who believe they can do whatever they want. There's no accountability. So in chapter 2 of Nahum, the middle chapter, there's a very graphic battle account. It's actually more graphic than the Babylonian version. There's a version in the Babylonian Chronicles, tablet number 21,901 in the British Museum. Look, lots of sources have survived from the ancient world, but the Bible is even more graphic. I'll just read it, a tiny bits. "I'm against you, declares the Lord Almighty. I will burn up your chariots in smoke. The sword will devour your young lions." Lions are sacred to Ishtar, the goddess of Assyria. "I will leave no prey on the earth. The voices of your messengers will no longer be heard." And then in chapter 3, and it's a very fast, very staccato, very rough kind of poetry here. Listen, "Woe to the city of blood, full of lies, full of plunder, never without victims. The crack of whips, the clatter of wheels, galloping horses and jolting chariots, charging cavalry, flashing swords and glittering spears, many casualties, piles of dead, bodies without number, people stumbling over the corpses, all because of the wanton lust of a prostitute, alluring the mistress of sorceries who enslave nations by her prostitution and peoples by her witchcraft." This sounds like the condemnation of Rome in the book of Revelation, where Rome is portrayed as Babylon. Very similar, but graphic here. All empires fall eventually, and Assyria herself caused the fall of many in the ancient world, but her time would come. But there's an example in chapter 3 of a city or city-state that Assyria had destroyed, and it's called Thebes, and it's in Egypt. And God says, "Are you better than Thebes, situated on the Nile, with her water around her? The river was her defense, the water was her wall. She was taken captive and went into exile, basically, as you did it. Her infants were dashed to pieces at every street corner. Lots were cast for her nobles. All her great men were put in chains." Thebes fell in 663 BC to the Assyrians. It was the capital of southern Egypt, a few hundred miles south of Cairo. But they had a sense of invincibility, kind of like Sardis in the book of Revelation. "No one will ever take us because they've got these cliffs on either side, and you know they feel protected." They're deceived, sadly deceived. And in fact, 51 years later, Nineveh herself will fall. Nineveh fell from its zenith actually even more quickly. Once the king Ashurbanipal died in 627, things were really going downhill. And in only a quarter a century, it was over. I think this has implications for today's empires. You know, we think it's unimaginable. How could China fall? How could the United States fall in 25 years? How could Russia fall? They were not paying attention to history. Nineveh fell from its zenith in only a quarter century. And one more passage. We read in chapter 3, the very end, "King of Assyria, your shepherds slumber. Your nobles lie down to rest. Your people are scattered on the mountains with no one to gather them. Nothing can heal you. Your wound is fatal. All who hear the news about you clap their hands at your fall, for who has not felt your endless cruelty?" And that's the end of the book of Nahum. Nineveh fell in 612. Her shepherds were slumbering. The nobles, the king, they failed the people. They didn't do what was right. And yet Nineveh seems to represent more than just Assyria. Nineveh, it seems to represent the empire that is against God. God is sovereign over history and the world. And he's good. But he does have an aspect of wrath. Because God is good, he's grieved and offended by cycles of oppression and violence and suffering. And if God were not offended by that, he wouldn't be good. Wrath is the justified response of God towards human sin and towards exploitation and cruelty. If God weren't angry, if he didn't punish, he wouldn't be a God worth worshiping because he wouldn't be truly good. Wrath is integral to his nature and his character. So don't backpedal. Don't back off. Don't try to remove the threat of anger from God. That doesn't work. He's holy And therefore, anger and jealousy, the so-called negative emotions, are rightly part of his character. Next, in iFaith, we'll have a message from Habakkuk called Utterly Amazed. Thanks.